Okay, we're just closing up our review now, and lesson 40, and then 41 is where we left off last year. So I want to say a few more things about lesson 40, just because these relative clauses are so important. I want to get a good review of these. So we left off yesterday in our review on page 236. We looked at the paradigm for the relative pronoun, which in many respects is like that of the article, although it does not have the tau in any of the forms, and it has rough breathing on all the forms, and it has accents on all the forms. So that's the main thing to observe there. But as far as the actual forms themselves are quite regular and predictable examples of your standard adjective type endings. Now, section 308 is giving a set of examples that are indicative of how these things are used in a sentence. And the point is that the gender and number of the relative pronoun is going to agree with the antecedent, or the word that the pronoun is referring back to. You see, a pronoun is a word that stands in for another noun. And a relative pronoun is one that stands in for another noun and occupies a position within a clause, tying one clause to another clause, and indicating the relationship of that one clause to the other one. And so, it's going to agree with its antecedent in number and gender, but not necessarily in case, because the case is going to be determined by its function within its clause, although that's subject to a qualification in section 309. But before we get to that, let's look at a few of these examples. In the first example here, in John 9:24, I'm going to try to rush through these fairly quickly. I'm just going to call your attention to the case of the relative pronoun and just read the English rather than reading through the Greek and all of these. But it said, they called a man who was blind. Okay. Notice that, well, it's hard to do this without reading all the Greek. But if only sent on anthropon, hos ein to flos. Okay, hos there is our relative pronoun. The antecedent is given in boldface. The antecedent is anthropon. So they call the man who was blind. Now, the form of host there is masculine singular to agree with anthropos, that's masculine singular. But the case is not the same. Anthropon is in the accusative case because it's occupying the direct object position within its clause. But host is in the nominative case because it is the subject of its clause. You see, they call the man who was blind. That's kind of combining two sentences. They call the man was blind. And if you kind of split it up that way, you can see how the relative pronoun is functioning within its clause. The phrase the man was blind is now becoming who was blind, and who is going to have to be in the nominative case because that's its function within its clause. Okay? So it's important to recognize where you have concord. Here's a beautiful example of the two rules of concord and government. Concord is seen in the case, excuse me, in the gender and number having to agree with the antecedent. And that shows you a linking of these things together. But then government is seen in terms of the case that's required by the relative pronoun within its clause, dependent upon, of course, its position within its clause. So there's one where the relative pronoun is nominative. Next example, makarioi hoi douloi ekenoi, hus ho kurios elthon, hirese gerog. Let's see, Gregorunta, excuse me. Now, notice it says, blessed are those servants whom the Lord will find watching when he comes. Blessed are those servants. That's a predicate construction, a predicate adjective construction. Blessed being a predicate adjective, and hoi douloi in the nominative case. And then whos, that says whom the Lord will find. There again, now the relative pronoun is in the accusative case because it's functioning as the direct object of its clause. See, the Lord will find them. Here again, if you split the sentence up into two independent sentences, you may be able to see what's happening. What it's essentially saying is, blessed are those servants, and the Lord will find those servants watching when he comes. And so the Lord will find those servants, and so the thing that represents servants, namely who's here, is going to have to be an accusative case, because that's where servants would have been within that clause. Okay. Now, the rest of the examples are similar, although we have different cases involved. In the next example, we have a dative case form for our relative pronoun. This is my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. The in whom there, en ho, omega with the other subscript, is dative. And it's referring back to huios, all right, masculine singular, but it's dative case now because it's the object of a preposition in that takes the dative. And so there we see that. Okay, question, Eric? Mm-hmm. Right, you will find them watching. And it's kind of a complementary participle. Your finite verb is heurisco, heurese here, and then this would be a participle. Of course, it's a contract verb, so you've got that omer and upsilon, you know, it's circumflex there. Okay. Any other questions? All right, then, I don't know if we'll go through the... Well, let's see. I should look at one that's genitive. If you look at Ephesians 3:7 here, Dia tu evangeliu hu egenethen diakonos, through the gospel of which I became a minister. Okay, the gospel of which. Notice the who here, genitive case, referring back to evangeliu, and it's neuter singular, but it's genitive. And it's genitive because it's the gospel of which I became a minister. And if it's the kind of the combination of two phrases, through the gospel, and then I became a minister of it. Of it, you see, of the gospel. And so of the gospel would be normally in the genitive case. And so it is here. Okay, so it would be a genitive phrase modifying minister. And in this case, the who is representing that thing that would have been in the genitive case. Okay, now, having said that, in section 309, we see a rather consistent exception to the rule. In the passages above, the case of the relative pronoun is in each instance determined by the function which it has in the relative clause. Usually, however, the case of the relative is assimilated or attracted to the case of the antecedent. Now, this means, then, that the case that the relative pronoun has is not going to be always the case that it's functioning within its clause. And that's important to note, because when you see examples of that, it can kind of throw you for a loop, you know, when you see something that is in the wrong case that you would expect. So this occurs especially under these conditions, especially if the case of the relative ought, as determined by its function in the relative clause, to be accusative, and if the case of the antecedent is genitive or dative. Okay, so in situations where the case of the antecedent of the relative pronoun is genitive or dative, and the case of the relative pronoun itself would have been accusative, it will tend to be attracted to the case of the antecedent, and it'll appear in either the genitive or the dative case, even though it's functioning as a direct object in its clause. And so that's going to seem a little strange at first. But I think the main reason for that seems to be trying to get an intimate tie between, an even more intimate tie than even gender and number would be done by even the case, and even the case seems to be attracted to the case of the antecedent. This doesn't happen all the time, but it usually happens, especially in this circumstance here. So let's look at a few examples of it and show you what we mean. So Matthew 24:50, Eixe ho kurios en hora he u ginoske, the Lord will come in an hour which he does not know. Okay, the Lord will come, there's your main phrase, and then en hora he u ginoske, in an hour, there hour is going to be in the dative case because it's the object of a preposition in, but then your relative clause he u ginoske, which would be an adjectival relative clause further qualifying what hour we're talking about, you would expect, you see, which he does not know. Know is a transitive verb, normally takes a direct object, so the idea is he does not know the hour. And you would normally have expected to have hein here, accusative feminine singular form. But instead we have hey, the dative form. So this is a case where attraction has taken place. And the case is now appearing in the case of the antecedent. Now you can almost see what that does, though, to your eye when you're reading along. You see this thing in the same case, and it connects it right back. You know, you're kind of almost immediate, without even having to look around, you know what that antecedent is to that relative pronoun. So it's helpful in that respect, although if you were to grammatically try to analyze this last phrase, hey, u, ginoske, and try to force a dative idea on hey there, you'd get in trouble. It just wouldn't work grammatically. So that's the main thing to watch. Yes, Greg?
What if I know that they're translating it as would be a direct object?
Yes, the translation is still coming out as a direct object in English. Right, exactly. And that's because you almost have to do that. It's because of the fact that this attraction of the case has taken place. The case has been attracted to the case of the antecedent, but its function, the function of that relative pronoun is still direct object within its clause. The case is only being attracted for purposes of connecting with the antecedent. It's not for purposes of trying to change any structure within that last clause. So we still translate it as a direct object. That's right. And if you were to diagram this sentence, you would put this particle here, even though it's in the dative case, you'd put it in a direct object position. And it's because of the fact that this rule involved. So these are the reasons why you need to know something about grammatical rules. Because if you came along with your handy-dandy analytical and looked up the case of that, and you knew a little bit about cases and so on, you wonder, what in the world's going on here? You know, how come I've got a dative case and it's functioning like a direct object? And it could generate no end of confusion if you weren't aware of the of what's happening here grammatically. Yes, Mark?
Do you think this happens, is it optional, or are you saying that it's...
Well, yeah, I'm not saying it's demanded. The way he's worded it here, it's usually done. There's usually an attraction that takes place. See, we just saw some examples above here where it wasn't done, and here especially under the conditions. And I think this may be the way we'll adopt a rule of thumb as far as exercises and so forth are concerned. That when the case of the relative pronoun ought to be accusative, and the antecedent is either dative or genitive, then go ahead and use the attraction rule. Under every other circumstance, don't use the attraction rule. Now, that'll get us right, you know, in phase with the text in the probably 90% of the cases, something like that. In other words, the vast majority of the time, that's what's going to happen. And then the rest of the time, you know, the other unusual exceptions or whatever, we can handle those one-on-one. But just to kind of get a rule of thumb, I think it's pretty safe to follow that. So it's usually it happens. Now, Robertson's big, thick grammar says that the nominative case, nominative form, is never attracted to the case of the antecedent. In other words, if the relative pronoun ought to be nominative within its clause, it's never going to be attracted to the case of the antecedent, regardless of what that is. So apparently nominatives aren't affected at all. And then, as far as this attraction is concerned, especially in Luke's writings, we tend to see this more frequently than we do in other writings. So there may be some stylistic variations and so forth as well that get involved here. But it's not a hard and fast rule. It's not going to be seen always, but usually. In other words, more often than not, you'll see an attraction take place under these circumstances. It ought to be accusative, and it's attracted to a genitive or dative. Okay. Here's another example, John 7:39. Epen peri tu pneumatos hu emelon lambanen. He spoke of the spirit which they were going to receive. All right, the spirit there, tu pneumatos, is genitive. And the last clause with a relative pronoun, who, in there, hu emelon lambanen, you would have expected hon there, ho, it's singular neuter. You would have expected ho because that is, within that clause, they were going to receive the spirit. They were going to receive it, and it would be in the accusative case normally. But it's in the genitive case here. It's attracted to the case of the antecedent. So here's again an example where it ought to be in the accusative, but the antecedent was genitive, and so it's attracted. Okay, same thing, same essential thing is happening in the next example, only with a feminine. Perites exousias aemon heis edoken hokurios. Yes?
Is the fact that anything to do with the proximity of the feminine?
Well, in the examples we've seen, you see a consistency there. There is proximity there. I can't say that that's going to happen always, because I haven't really looked at all the examples of them. That'd be something that someone would have to do a study and make observation. But I think it might be a working hypothesis to consider. If there's proximity there, there may be a more pressure, you might say, to have a conformity there, and that seems plausible. But like I say, having not investigated every case, we might just keep that in the back of our minds as we're translating. When we run into places where attraction has occurred, let's just try to take note. Is there proximity there? In other words, is the relative pronoun following almost immediately on the antecedent? And that, I think, is a hypothesis. I don't know if it's true or not. But if we can check it as we go, we'll see if it seems to bear out. But they apparently are making this qualification that is generally in the instances in which accusative is being attracted to genitive or dative.
Mm-hmm. I have a note here. Apparently, you made the comment last year that for the dative, it's never used in less than a prepositional phrase.
Okay.
And it is also used outside of prepositional phrase, but rarely like the second phrase. So, can you excuse me, that's a prepositional phrase.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, it's never seen outside of
data,
outside of
prepositional phrase. Okay. You mean a situation of attraction to a data? Yeah, okay. That might have been another statement I had. I didn't have it written down here, but I did look this up in some of the other grammars and gave some more statements. So if you wrote that down, that's probably what another qualification to it. Okay. Yes.
In such a DLA, there are some, like Luke 23:29, you've got.
Well, let's see. Luke. Oh, okay. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Luke 23:29. Okay, I was looking at the wrong one there. Blessed are the wombs. Well, we have here. Actually, what you have is a nominative in both cases. See, hi koilei is nominative, plural, feminine, and then hi would be your nominative.
They're both genitive.
Ephesians 3:7, yeah, they're both genitive there. Yeah. No, you can't really tell from that one because, well, because it's the gospel of which there's no attraction there because genitive would be required in the relative phrase there too. So it's only places where accusative would be required in the relative clause, but the antecedent was genitive or dative, and then you'll see attraction there. That's the primary place where attractions occur. Presumably in other situations too, but never in the nominative. Nominatives are never attracted, and apparently datives only in prepositional phrase ideas. Okay, so that's something we'll just have to keep our eyes on and be aware of. Like I said, if on tests or exercises, we'll just adopt that rule of thumb that only in instances where it ought to be accusative, but the antecedent is genitive or dative. In those instances, then we'll have you go ahead and have the case be attracted. Okay, the section 3:10, the long forms hostis for host, hatis for hey, hoti for sometimes printed hoti, two separate words, or even ho, and then t for is equivalent to ho here, hoitines for hoi, hi-tines for hi, and the hatina for ha, do not differ in meaning from the short forms indicated as their equivalents. You've got a footnote here, just because the whole paradigm isn't worth writing out just because it doesn't occur in the New Testament. It's just these forms are the only ones that occur in the New Testament. I think they're all nominative forms here. And it says, these do not differ in meaning from the short forms indicated as their equivalents. It should be noted, however, that none of these long forms is ever attracted to the case of the antecedent. And I don't know if there's a rule for that. Maybe you could come up with a grammatical inertia rule or something like that, that something as massive as this isn't going to change. I don't know. There almost seems to be that kind of thing. After you've been in Greek and Hebrew for a while, you tend to see the things that are not so heavy and big tend to get shortened where other things don't. You know, it's kind of an interesting principle anyway. Someone ought to write a paper on that idea. But here, these longer forms, they're not used that often, but when they are used, they do not follow this attraction rule. Yes. Steve?
That also be because they're all nominative. They never.
Yeah, the nominatives, if the only ones that occur are nominatives, that settles it anyway. The nominatives are never attracted. So it may be due to that and not due to the fact that the word is longer. So that's a good point. Okay. So I don't think we'll bother with going through all the examples on that. Pretty straightforward. 3:11. Relative clauses occasionally precede their antecedents. This order may be altered when translating into English. Now, as far as translating English is concerned, we know that word order in Greek and word order in English don't necessarily correspond, so I think you're just saying that you may want to translate it in your normal word order in English. However, I don't think you're going to go too far wrong just by translating literally. That's what they do here anyway. Hos eche do thesetai auto, to him who has it shall be given. I guess his point is that in English we might normally translate that it shall be given to him who has, or something like that, and put it shall be given first. But we don't have any trouble understanding to him who has it shall be given, and so I don't see any compelling reason to change things around on that score alone. generally, if the word order in Greek becomes very awkward if we put it in English, then you want to change it. But if it's not awkward, if it works okay, I have a tendency to want to leave it in the Greek word order just because there's certain emphatic, you know, word order in Greek is variable, and because it's variable, certain emphases can be generated by adjusting the word order. And if you can get those transmitted in English, I think that's to your advantage. Okay, and the Matthew 3:12 is the same thing, only with hostess rather than host. Okay, 3:12. The antecedent of a relative pronoun need not be expressed in Greek. In translating in English, however, it is usual to supply one. So sometimes in a Greek construction, you may see a relative pronoun there with no clear antecedent. And that is almost like a substantive function. Just like, you know, sometimes you see an adjective and doesn't have anything modified. It's not modifying anything in the text. And that we call it a substantive. This is a very much akin to that. Look at the example here. Hos uk esten kath hemon, huper hemon esten. He who is not against us is for us. Okay, the hos here is being translated he who, rather than who is not for against us is for us. In English, we, you know, in Greek, you can get by with just using the relative pronoun and make it almost a substantive, and it doesn't have any clear antecedent. It's kind of talking about an indefinite he, you know, whoever it is, whosoever, as it were. So there's reasons for that, but it doesn't have a clear antecedent. And in English, we may put a he in there and make that our antecedent, you know, it's supplying that. That would be the normal way to do it in English, but in Greek you don't need that. So it's kind of a substantive use, I would say. Although really a relative pronoun is basically substantive no matter how you look at it, since it's taking the place of a noun. But in this sense, there's no antecedent, and an antecedent is being understood by the fact that there's nothing there to refer to in the context. And it gives an indefiniteness to it, and a kind of a generality to it. He who, whoever who, you see. Whosoever, as it were. Okay, and section 3:13, a lot of details here. Yes, go ahead, Eric.
The relative pronoun can be used down with the article, right?
No, you won't see the relative pronoun used with the article because it's already got a definiteness by being a pronoun. Remember, we had rules before that something that's a pronoun is automatically definite. So it'd be kind of redundant to do that. Okay, then section 3:13. I will say this though: there are times when there can be debate between whether a given word is an article or a relative pronoun, especially in those nominative forms where the only difference is an accent. And most of your other, you know, you would have a tau on the article, but in some of the forms you see like hoi or hi or ho or hey, those four forms. The only difference between the relative pronoun and the article formally is the accent. And it may not be obvious right now, but we will run into situations where that could be debated. It turns out, though, that either way, the meaning is going to come out approximately the same. If you take it as the article will usually then be construed as applying to a whole phrase. And in that case, it ends up being pretty much like the relative pronoun anyway. So semantically, it seldom is going to make much difference. And that's perhaps why there's some debate about it, too, because it would fit either way. Okay. The section 3:13, the relative pronoun itself is frequently omitted in English, but it is never omitted in Greek. In other words, in English, sometimes we can throw the pronoun out. He told me everything I did. Well, you see, the word everything I did means literally everything that I did, everything which I did, something like that. And technically, or rigorously, you might say, in the most rigorous form, we would normally put a that or a which in there. But because we say these things so frequently, we make everything almost a kind of a transitional word in itself. And the fact that we say everything kind of opens the door to qualification to it, and it's been done so customarily that we don't even use the relative pronoun. But in Greek, you won't omit the relative pronoun. So when you look at the Greek equivalent there, epen moi panta ha epoiesa. You wouldn't say in the Greek, epen moi panta epoiesa, but panta ha epoiesa. If you're going to use a relative pronoun construction, that's the way you'll do it. Now, there are such things as participial constructions, and where you can put a participle and a substantive and get some similar ideas, but as long as you're using relative pronoun construction, you're going to have the relative pronoun in there. You're not just going to throw it out. Okay. Then in section 314, when the neuter forms of the Greek relative occur without an expressed antecedent, they may often be rendered by the English what. So these neuter forms, this is somewhat analogous to what we saw back in section 312, where you might see something and no antecedent stated. This is, again, a kind of a situation where there's no clear antecedent, but it's in the neuter now, and it puts it kind of in a what type of mode, or a neuter kind of an explanatory thing that's general. So, ho, you mean lego, possen lego. What I tell you, I tell all. So, what is kind of standing almost as, that which I tell you, or that what those, you know, that which, those which, depending on whether it's singular or plural. And in fact, if you look at the bottom here, this another statement. In this use, the English what is sometimes called a compound relative, as it is equivalent to that which or those which. So, in other words, we're almost, again, giving a substantive idea to the that and letting it stand all by itself as if it's functioning as a noun. And so he calls this a compound relative. In other words, it's got the idea of that and a substantive idea as well as having a relative pronoun idea. Kind of mixes a couple of things. So I don't think that's ever going to present a real problem for you. When you see it, you won't be able to do anything else with it. So that's kind of guarantee what the translation will be. All right, then section 315. It is obvious that relative clauses express many of the meanings expressed by articular participles. Let's compare these two sentences, for example. Pas hostis akue mu tus logus aututus. Everyone who hears these words of mine. And then Matthew 7:26. Pas ho akuon mu tus logus tutus. And these are just two verses apart, but it shows you a comparison between these structures. Again, the translation is everyone who hears these words of mine. And it's being translated exactly the same in English. And one of them, the first one, is a relative pronoun construction, hostis being your relative pronoun, and then akue being a finite verb form. Whereas the second example here is pas ho akuon. That's a participle. And everyone who hears, every hearing one, as it were. Now, their translation in English is just exactly the same here. That I think should caution you, though, to the way in this particular instance they come out being translated roughly the same, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're identical in meaning, that they're totally synonymous. There's a shade of difference, a slight nuance of difference between these two, and I suppose it has something to do with the fact that the participle tends to give you more of a concept of a progressive or a continual or a more intrinsic part. See, everyone who hears using the relative pronoun might be just a reference to a person hearing on an occasion or something or at a particular time, but everyone who hears with a participle is kind of like you're saying every hearing one, everyone who's, you know, this seems to be more intrinsically associated with the person when you substantivize a participle like that. So you get a slight shade of difference as far as the feeling of the thing is concerned, even though that may not be reflected in the translation. Now, that means then that you can transform a relative clause into an articular participial construction many times, not always. And you'll see the breakdown here. And I want to look at this so you can see the difference here. But you have, for example, ho aner hos lege tauta. How would that be translated in English? Anybody? Yes, the man who is speaking these things, okay? And then that's equivalent to ho aner ho legon tauta. Again, the same thing, the man who is speaking these things, but now with a participial construction. Now, let's look at the next example, though, the next series of examples, and you'll see that you can't always do this. Ho aner hu tus logus tutus, tus logus akuo. Okay, how would that be translated in English? Anyone? Glenn? Yes, the man whose words I hear. Okay, could we transfer this and translate this into a clause with the same meaning, only using participles? Okay, no, you can't. In fact, he says down here that you can't be transformed in this way. Well, why can't they be transformed in this way? Simply. The only way, the only reason it works for participles is in instances where the, how should I put this? The participial construction is essentially making a substantive out of a participle, which is normally an adjective, verbal adjective type of an idea. And the only way it'll work is if the subject of the verb idea, how should I say this? It'll only work is in instances for the relative pronoun. Say if we're going from a relative pronoun construction to a participial construction, we want to convert it into. It'll only work when the relative pronoun was the subject of the verbal idea, because the participle, you see, is going to involve substantivizing this verbal idea, and that will mean that the thing that's being substantivized is the subject of that verbal idea, is the one who's doing the action, the one who's hearing, whatever. If on the other hand, we want to say the man whose words I hear, I'm the one that's doing the hearing now. And I'm hearing his words. The words of him I'm hearing. And now what we have is that the relative pronoun is in the genitive case, and it is not the subject of the verbal idea, but it's rather in a different position in the sentence. And that makes it impossible to use a participial construction to translate that construction. Now, I'm not saying that participles never occur in genitive situations where they do, but you can't make a transformation of a relative clause into a participial phrase unless the relative, you know, that's basically equivalent, unless the relative clause has its relative in the nominative case, as it were. That's the subject of the verbal idea. That's the only way it'll work. Okay, John?
Maybe I'm wrong, but it appears that the relative pronoun basically takes a third-person concept. You know, it's a like he, she, it, as opposed to second. So the verb then that would have to be
third-person verb form third too. Person yeah, form as well.
Also.
Yeah. I think that's
accurate.
I think that's a fair assessment as well, because your relative pronoun, again, now it's possible to have a relative pronoun that actually refers to the first person, but it's not semantically referring to the first person. In other words, if you've got your context and so forth and you're talking about yourself, I who am a such and such, then you may have that relative pronoun have the antecedent as an I or a you, you who do this and so forth, but
that'll be a separate
clause. If you look at the clause, who do this, you've still got a third-person idea, and you're going to still have to use a third-person verb form.
Right.
So that's definitely right grammatically. And we will see other pronouns, of course, the personal pronouns that we talked about before. You do have first-person personal pronouns over, but they're not relative pronouns anymore. The whole idea of a relative pronoun is giving a further description of something and using that pronoun to stand in for the thing, and so that's naturally going to end up in third-person forms. Well, that's another good observation. Okay, Gwen?
Well, I was thinking you actually could, I haven't figured out the genitive one yet, the first one, but the next two, one's dative, one's accusative in this example, and I figured you could actually convert into participles, because what the participle is doing is eating up the verb in these two, and you can't use the verb because the subject of these other two is using the verb. So if you transform the whole edoka, to whom I gave, if you put it in a passive participle.
Right, yeah, you could do it there, then you could make that the subject.
Apply me the
right.
You could get away with the same thing with the accusative.
Sure.
You know, to whom I, you know, who was seen by me.
Right.
Like that.
Yeah, you can do it that way if you use the passive participle. That's a good point, because that way you can make that the subject of the action, and then you can do it. But of course, that's another step. You have to make one more step in it. And in fact, what you have had to do is rewrite the sentence, as it were, and put a different type of verb and you know, passive construction and so forth, and then just to get that thing in the right position. So there, you could do some juggling and still come up with it, but you'd have to actually change the initial sentence to a passive construction to do it. Okay, good. But that shows you the essential problem, the essential idea, is to get that relative into a position of a subject to the verb. Then you can use a participle. Okay, good. And since there are passive participles, we can do that way. Of course, the genitive, you're out of luck, because you're not going to be able to. Although, even there are certain verbs that take genitive objects, so in a very few instances that might even work for a genitive. but it's, you know, that wouldn't be your normal rule by any means. Okay, we'll get to some of those verbs later on, near one of the chapters down the road, one of them near the end talks about some of those verbs. Okay, section 3.16, like participles, both anarthrous and articular relative clauses may express various shades of meaning. Thus, Romans 6.2, the relative clause may be held to express cause. I think this kind of discussion here is mostly taking context plus the structure to come up with something. In fact, he even cautions at the end here, however, both these clauses may be merely descriptive. After saying that it may express cause or express purpose, then he says they may be just descriptive. And I think that the idea of cause or purpose may be seen with relative pronouns, constructions, but it's only because there's context that's added to it. It has to do with the meaning of the words and the kind of a setting that they're involved in. And so I think in general it's best not to even worry about cause or purpose. Let the context handle that and just translate the relative pronoun as it should. You see, his point here is Romans 6:2, hoi tenes apethanomen te hamartia pos eti zesumen en aute. Because we have died to sin, how shall we live in it, still live in it? What would that literally be translated? He's got the because in here, but that's not really there. Yes. Right. We who have died to sin, how shall we live in it still? Or how shall we, you know, yet live in it? Okay. Now, even if you take the because out of there, and it's like the King James has, we who have died to sin, how shall we? You still get that idea from the context. You don't need to put a because in there. You still get it. And I think that's kind of a safer way to go. It's really context that's giving you that. All the Greek really says is, we who have died to sin, how shall we live in it long as they're in? And because of the meaning of the words and the arrangement of them, you get this idea of cause and effect. But it's not necessarily something that's seen right in the word. So I'm inclined to want to make a distinction between whether something is grammatically shown or whether it's contextually shown. Not that it's not there. It's just that we need to make a distinction as to why. Lest we make an error, you see, the problem that can come is if a person sees something like this, he can wrongly infer that any time a relative pronoun is used, there's cause. And that is not the case. It's only here because you've got relative pronoun construction plus context that is being shown. Same thing in this next example. So, right, whenever he wants it, yeah, for his own theological bias purposes, yeah. So that's what we mean by having enough Greek to be dangerous, you know. Yeah.
It seems like that would be really an accurate way to look at the process. Then. Because we have died for sin, that's not a reason for how
right.
We shall live in it or not.
Right.
It doesn't seem, at least it doesn't seem right off the.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily imply. See, sometimes you've got to be careful with it so that you don't read into it cause when it's not really saying that. And there may be, what you may have is a correlation, but not necessarily cause and effect. And, you know, from scientific, if you had some training in scientific circles, you know you've got to make a distinction. You can construct data tables to show a correlation between two things. But to infer the cause and effect is there may sometimes be wrong. What you may be having is a third cause causing both effects, and these are two effects that always occur as a result of third cause, and it's not because of a cause and effect relationship between the two. So the same kind of things can happen grammatically, and you have to be careful. Don't try to read into it any more than what it really says. Yes?
Especially since Greek would have a better way of saying it.
Right. Yes. Exactly. Well, there are other types of clauses that we're going to get to a little bit later on, subordinate clauses and so forth, structures that very clearly indicate cause and effect relationships, and also purpose. And we've seen infinitive constructions and other things that are showing purpose. We see prepositional phrases like ace and pros, and with infinitives that have a real graphic and definite purpose idea. So I think that that's another consideration. When you have something real clear that's doing it, don't be too quick to read something in to something that's not so clear. And build a theology on it. Good point. Okay, then a few other relatives. Oh, go ahead, Eric, before we move on. Yes, genitive absolute construction. That is more. Again, see, we talked about this before with genitive absolute, is that don't necessarily infer a purpose or a cause and effect there either. Mainly correlation. In other words, this is happening same time as this is happening. And then there, because of the context, again, there may be cause and effect involved, but again, it's not grammatically being forced. All the grammar is showing a circumstantial type. See, that's a species of a circumstantial participle. And just showing these circumstances are going on at the same time as these are. and there may be connection. Usually there is. Usually there's some kind of connection. But that connection will probably be a semantic one. In other words, based on the meanings of the words involved and the kinds of events that are associated, rather than a grammatical one. So, in other words, we don't want to say that some of these constructions have no cause and effect involved or have no purpose idea involved, but if there is a purpose idea or if there is a cause and effect idea, it's a semantic, it's based on the meaning of the words that are used in the sentence and the context. It's not based on the grammar. And yet we have means in the grammar to unambiguously indicate cause and effect or purpose without recourse to looking at context or anything else. And so it's important to know what we have at our disposal and to help evaluate what a particular passage may or may not be. Okay. Other relatives in section 317, there are other types of words that are used to set off relative clauses other than the relative pronouns. Greek has relative adjectives, and they're sometimes used substantively so that they can function kind of like pronouns too. And then relative adverbs. When these introduce relative clauses, the relative adjectives have adjectives as antecedents. In other words, they're taking the place of some adjective idea, unless, of course, they bring you substantively, and then they can refer back to a noun or something. And the relative adverbs have adverbs as antecedents. Relative adverbs, however, frequently have as antecedents nouns indicating place or time. Now, that's simply because a noun that indicates place or time is functioning adverbially. I mean, that's really what the function of it is, and you'll see this kind of thing happen lots of times where a noun indicating place or time is used like an adverb in the sentence, and so it's no wonder that the relative adverbs pick up on this. In all cases, antecedents may be omitted, as with relative pronouns, but may be inferred from the context. Okay, I don't want to go through all the details of this. This is pretty easy to see, but there's a relative adjective hoios. With alpha and on there. This is a standard adjective like kalos, except, of course, since the stem ends in a vowel, you're going to have the alpha-type bendings, so you have the alpha for the feminine. But means such as or as. And here's an example. His garments became glistening, very white, such as no fuller on earth could bleach them. You've got lauka there for white, and then hoya, your relative adjective, referring back to that lauka. And such as, white such as. In other words, the such as is describing the degree or the comparison to the idea of white, which was an adjective, and therefore you use the relative adjective. Okay, hoios is frequently correlated with toyutos. So you have hoios, toyutos, that type of construction. So and such. The idea is, you know, as this is, so is this. Such as this is, so is this. That's the idea, where you've got an obvious comparison between two things. So one, I'll just read one example here. Hoios hoikos toyutoi kai hoi koikoi. Koikoi. Koikoi, excuse me, kind of reversed. As was the man of dust, so are they who are dust. So as this is, so this is. Just this kind of comparison. In fact, we're going to see a lot of these kinds of comparative words where you see one and the other. In fact, it's this next chapter with coordinating conjunctions. We'll see a lot of that kind of thing. Very interesting. Then hosos, as much as or as many as, similar kind of usage. All who or all which or all that. Using that way, those ways. Eporeson en auto hosa they did with him all that or as many things as they wished. See, all the things that they wished. So it was neuter plural here. And this is almost, it's functioning like a substantive here, but it's referring to things, so all things or as many things.
Mm-hmm. This is a side point, but in 1 Corinthians 15:48,
mm-hmm.
are there no verbs?
Oh, yes, none indicated here. It's just a predicate type construction. You see, it's a predicate adjective construction, as it were. And the translation of was is probably coming from context. See, there isn't any, unless the actual sentence has the verbs in it, and they're not showing it in the clause here, I suspect that we're just seeing a predicate construction here. See, whole koikos, the man of dust. As this, so the other is, you know, so you're kind of supplying the verb to be. So you might check it just to see if the if the text is the same. If it is, then it's a predicate construction, and the verbs are being understood. And the tense idea wouldn't necessarily be as was the man of dust, so are those who are dust, but it might be as is and so is. It's just kind of using a conceptual comparison rather than zeroing in time. No verbs? Okay. Okay. And so, see, we have nominative forms for the adjectives in both cases, singular and plural, so it's a predicate construction. All right, any other questions? This hosos is sometimes correlated with tosutos, so much, so many. So much as this, you know, so much the more as you see the day approaching, you know, that type of an idea. So you'll start tosuto, malon, hoso, lepetes, kind of interesting parallels. Then relative adverb, hopu, meaning where. This will be an adjective. Oh, wait a minute, it should be an adverb. It'd be an adverb. It's just that Bethany here happens to be a noun, but it's the name of a place. And so you can still have a relative adverb there since it's the name of a place. So hopu would be a relative adverb. Sometimes it's correlated with ekke, which means there. So where this is, there this is. You know, where your treasure is, there is your heart will be. Who, meaning where, not, is synonymous with hopu. So it's maybe just a shorter form of that. Nothing more to say about that. Hos, as, or like. That's a very common word in comparisons. And again, this is a relative adverb, so it's not going to decline. Hos is sometimes correlated with hutos. Hos and hutos. So usually it would be hutos first. Thus such and such, as such and such. In other words, example here, thus I run, not as aimlessly. Thus I box, not as one beating the air. See? Hutos and hos. Hutos, I do this. Hos, as, or like. So you can translate them both pretty literally, thus and as, and come out pretty well. Hotem, meaning when. Hour is coming when I shall no longer speak to you in figures. So again, it's a relative adverb, setting up, introducing a relative clause and giving a whole clause that describes something in terms of, in this case, describing a time period. Hote is sometimes correlated with tote. Hote something, tote something. When the grass came up, then the weeds appeared. When this happened, then this happened. And here you can see very often, maybe not cause and effect relationships, but conditional relationships, conditional clauses. If this, then this, or in the case when this, then this, is one type of showing a correlation and condition. Then hothen, whence, from where, same kind of thing, relative adverb, I shall return to the house, whence I came out, hothen, exilthon. Those are pretty straightforward, I think. Mostly vocabulary, more than anything else, I think. All right, questions, anybody, on this chapter? It's not one of the easier chapters, I don't think, but it's one that we're going to be running into. The rules given in this chapter we're going to be running into constantly. Just like with participles. You can hardly read a few sentences in Greek without running into a relative pronoun. And it's hard to read a few sentences without running into pronoun. I mean, participle, excuse me. Okay, that brings us to chapter 41, coordinating conjunctions. This is a chapter that doesn't have a lot of grammar per se in it. It's mostly vocabulary, but there are some peculiarities to the vocabulary words. These vocabulary words, like prepositions, are function words. And so when you see words that are function words, of course, there's more to understanding the vocabulary than just getting a one-word equivalent for it. It's having to understand how that word or set of words is functioning within the Greek structure. So these are quite important, just like prepositions. So coordinating conjunctions. First of all, a conjunction is an uninflected word. So we can rejoice over that. No inflections to worry about. An uninflected word which serves to connect other words or larger syntactic units in certain special ways which will be described in this lesson. Conjunctions are of two types, coordinating and subordinating. Coordinating and subordinating. So coordinating basically is joining things together on an equal par, as it were, two things of an equal standing. Subordinating is joining things together where one is dependent on the other, one is subordinate to the other. That's the basic distinction, but we'll refine that as we go through and look at some of these definitions in more detail. Now, we just had gotten started with this when we ran out of time last year. I think we've gotten through the first page or so. So this is mostly going to be new. First of all, coordinating conjunctions connect syntactic units with other syntactic units of the same grammatical type. So they kind of connect things that are of the same kind. In other words, Substantive to substantive, adjective to adjective, verb to verb, phrase to phrase, clause to clause. In other words, you've got two things that are similar grammatical units. This coordinating conjunction can join those together and make a compound out of them. So the construction formed in this way can have the same grammatical function as either of the constituents joined by the conjunction could have alone. A few English examples will be given by way of illustration. So we have here sentence A, the boy washed the dishes. Sentence B, the girl dried the silverware. In each of these two sentences, we have a familiar structure, subject, verb, object, where the subject and object in each are nouns, each with a definite article, and where the V is a transitive verb. These constituents may be joined by coordinating conjunctions in a number of ways. Okay, first sentence C, the boy and girl washed the dishes. Here what we have is the two nouns that are functioning as subject in the sentence are joined together by the word and. And so we have a compound subject here is what it's termed. And if you were to diagram this, you would diagram it in such a way that you would have both of these things on the subject line and show an indication of an and between them. And it won't be too long and we're going to start doing diagramming. So I think that one nice thing about diagramming is that it conceptualizes and solidifies your grammatical rules. That's the reason to do it. It's not because, you know, it's fun just to draw pictures. That's not what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is, in our minds, conceptualize what's going on grammatically. And diagramming is very helpful in that respect. I can remember diagramming English. It was one of the most fun parts for me of English grammar was diagramming. I suppose because I'm, you know, mathematically oriented and so forth. But it was interesting just to see the relationships. And I think that will help solidify many of these rules. And you'll start to, you know, really start grasping them in a deeper level. Well, and diagramming in Greek is going to be quite a bit more complicated than anything you've had in English. But some of the diagrams, especially we're going to hit some of Paul's epistles. And when you start diagramming them, you almost have to have a dotted line at the top and a dotted line on the bottom going to the sentence before and the sentence after. It's almost impossible to isolate something in Paul's epistles. But we'll have fun with those not too long from now. Okay, so boy and girl, compound subject here. And then, you could also put the article on both of them individually. The boy and the girl wash the dishes. Sentence D here. You see, in sentence C, the article, there's only one article applying to both. And in sentence D, you have the article on each one individually. That's something to kind of keep in mind. Later on, we're going to talk about the Granville-Sharp's rule. And that, in Greek, it involves the use of the article, and whether the article covers both terms or whether it applies individually to each term. And that can have some semantic implications, too. And not the same as in English here, but it's got some interesting implications in Greek. So here there's a slight difference here as far as D. The constructions the boy and the girl are grammatically similar constituents joined by and the resulting coordination of these functions as subject, just as each did in A and B respectively. Okay, but it's a slightly different construction because now we have two phrases, the noun with its article, these two phrases being joined by and, whereas before we just had two words, boy and girl, joined by and then the article applying to that unit. Okay, then you can compound the verbs. The girl washed and dried the dishes. Now you have a compound verb. The two verbal constituents are joined by and. And then F, the boy washed the dishes and the silverware. Okay, here the two objects are coordinated. And then G, the boy and the girl washed and dried the dishes and silverware. Here you have a compound subject, compound verb, and compound direct object. You can put them all together and deal with each one of these units. Okay, then he gives some formula writing here. I don't think that's necessary to belabor. I think you can pretty well see the point. Now, sentence H, he says, the boy washed the dishes and the girl dried the silverware. Now, in this situation, we have two complete independent sentences, and the two sentences are joined by and. So there's entire units of meaning here that are joined by and. And sentences are grammatical constituents. And so we have two grammatical constituents of the same kind being joined together. So this is what we call a compound sentence, where you have and joining whole sentences. And the Hebrew students probably recognize that almost the entire Old Testament is one gigantic compound sentence because of the while consecutive kind of construction, the ands and so forth. It's kind of interesting that way. Okay, that's all the time we have. For tomorrow, I guess that what I will do, this lesson 41 exercise is very short, and it's just a translation of Greek to English. and I don't think it's going to involve much at all. So go ahead and do 41A for tomorrow, even though we haven't gotten into the details of it. This will be kind of a useful means of doing that. And just for Monday, I'm sorry. Yeah, Tuesday, for Tuesday. For next Tuesday, 41A. That's the only one that's there. It's just one page, basically, and it'll be pretty straightforward. Because I would like to go through that as soon as we get through this information. Okay. Good.